in this fifth week of Lent, we've been taking on absences in all sorts of ways, and we're taking on absence of voice tonight. So in addition to the fact that I'm, besides the fact that I'm opening us by speaking, I'll be a little bit less speaking. But glad that you're here, and we'll call together as we have for the last 4 weeks with an erasure poem from the week's text, drafted by our own Rody. And this one is maybe as Rody as any of them have been. There was a priest named Elizabeth. Elizabeth was serving God. The Lord was terrified. Fear overwhelmed him, but Elizabeth said, "I stand in the presence of good news. Words will be fulfilled. Speak them," Elizabeth said. "Lord, look, grace." So, as we sit in this fifth week of Lent and reflecting on absence of voice, we're looking tonight at that text from Luke that ends in a canticle of Zechariah and begins with Zechariah being silenced and all the things that open up in that absence of voice. In terms of announcements, things going on, in this way we're sort of really coming around the bend towards Easter, one more Sunday of Lent, and we'll do as we have, I think for a lot of years, we're planning a Monday Thursday service, which is going to be here in this place, right? At what time?
7 o'clock.
So 7 o'clock on Monday Thursday, which is April 18th. Still kind of figuring out exactly what that looks like, but that's typically, yeah, been our way of practicing Holy Week together, so it has some Good Friday elements in it. Yeah, looking forward to that time together. It should be quite short and kid-friendly if you have kids that would like to come with you for that. But I don't think, what was our thing on childcare? I'm not planning to offer childcare. We're going to have half an hour in and out. But yeah, please put that on your calendar and think about celebrating Holy Week together as a community. Another thing I'll say is Pup Group's about to take on another series that we invite you to come out on Thursday night for, or just put in your own reading list and read along with us. We're going to take on the memoir Educated. You might have heard about it. It's done a ton of rounds. I think it made it on the New York Times bestseller list. It's by Tara Westover, who spent most of her childhood in sort of fundamentalist Mormon prepper enclave in the 1990s, and then ended up going on to higher education and became a PhD, and sort of wrote about the two polarities of that experience. We're excited to take that one on. We'll probably start reading this Thursday. I'm glad you're reading that through the month of May. So if that's something you want to pick up, just kind of be part of that ongoing community conversation. Great. Anything else?
Everyone who's on Eway Social should have got an email about the two upcoming meetings that the lead team has organized. I can't remember the exact dates off the top of my head because I'm here with two kids, but if you look on Eway Social, there's two upcoming dates just for community building and information.
The 14th, so next Sunday morning at 10, and the 23rd at
7 p.m. I think both of those are sort of continuing conversation that we opened at our February FSCA gathering on Sunday evening about sustainability in a financial sense, but also just sustainability in the next phase and the sort of ongoing development of this community. And the team's really reaching out to try and make that a broad conversation and hear from a lot of you. And those are two intentional ways that you could speak into that and talk to other amazing folks about that. That was a good one. Anyone else? Well, in that case, I'm going to invite Ruby, who knows this song better than anyone, to lead us once more in our community song.
Yes, the penultimate leading. We're not talking about Easter.
No.
So yes, penultimate. Okay. So let's just all join in as you feel it is familiar to you.
Joyful is the dark, holy hidden God, holy cloud of night beyond all naming, majesty in darkness, energy of love, word in flesh the mystery proclaiming. Joyful is the dark,
noticing the connections among the stories, finding the patterns, and giving words to what I discover along the way. My passion for words comes with a deep desire to be articulate, both on the page and in person. I've become particularly aware of how I'm perpetually engaged in a process to find the right words amid the constant flow of syllables running through my brain and taking shape on my tongue or through my hand. Might these lovely silent pages help create a space in which I can hear not just my own words, but the word from whom we await in this season? Is there some place I might cede some of my own attachment to being articulate so that the word can find its way in? Jan Richardson.
I was going to die, sooner or later, whether or not I had even spoken myself. My silences had not protected me. Your silences will not protect you. What are the words you do not yet have? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them still in silence? We have been socialized to respect fear more than our own need for language. Next time, ask, what's the worst that will happen? Then push yourself a little further than you dare. Once you start to speak, people will yell at you, they will interrupt you, put you down, and suggest it's personal, and the world won't end. Audrey Lord.
Therefore, since the spirit of silence is so important, permission to speak should rarely be granted even to perfect disciples. Disciples, even though it be for good, holy, edifying conversation. For speaking and teaching belong to the Master. The disciples' part is to be silent and to listen.
There's noise everywhere. In our homes are screens and speakers with images and sounds of every sort. There are sounds outside, along the roads, in the stores, on automobiles. There are screens in gas stations, in doctor's offices, restaurants. There are speakers in airports, on elevators, in our cars. We are bombarded by externally generated thoughts that muscle in on our own. And often they simply replace our own. Hence the tendency to brand our Facebook pages with favorite songs, movies, TV shows, and so on, which allow us plug-and-play personality. In such a context, silence is like withdrawal. And there's the rub. We've become addicted to noise, anything that distracts us from cultivating a practice of careful thinking, reflection, and its natural consequent, prayer. For when we think and reflect upon the things we think about, One effect is a sense of wonder at it all. Tim Muldoon.
Words mean more than what is set down on paper. It takes the human voice to infuse them with deeper meaning. Maya Angelou.
So with all those thoughts, words about voice, about silence, sitting with us, we move to the table. Just to recap why this table is sitting here in the middle of this space. In this way, this Lent, as we've been talking about attitudes of power at home, and control, and convention, and this week voice, we've been taking on certain absences, certain changes in the way that we're gathering together on Sunday night. And so we began by fasting from snacks and coffee, and then we moved on to recentering this table to the middle of our space in a more deliberate way. And then we started reordering elements of our worship gathering and kind of putting this table in the center and not framed in quite the same way with confession and absolution as it often is. And then last week we started circling up like this in the roundest we've sort of ever been. And all of these as ways to say physically, tangibly, to invite us as a community to reflect differently on the absences we're discussing, but also to say, in the familiarity that comes from gathering with these people in this space in such a typical way, so we're talking about we've been in this space for a year and a half, and already it's like we've already met elsewhere. It starts to seem distant, different. So what is it in taking on these absences, these differences during Lent, to say, what does my presence mean in this space where they come? What about the peculiar way of gathering together that we have, the peculiar way of listening and being accountable to each other's voices, is uniquely valuable, such that when we take everything we've rearranged and arrange it back at Easter, what way will that feel like home, order, power, voice that we might have missed? So I hope you're getting some of that. But with that, I invite you to the table tonight in the middle of this gathering as we head towards a dialogue about the absence of voice in this particular text and the ways that we lack the voice to say all that we might say or want to say or feel must be said at times in our world. I'd invite you to come to this table to a practice that does not require your voice. And in that, to trust that we have become particularly aware of how we are perpetually engaged in a process to find the right words. We're smart people. We're people who like right words, the exact way of saying things, the exact words to arrange such that we could be right and right in the world. But I think this table creates a space in which we could hear not just our own words, but the word for whom we wait in this season. Is there some place? Is this a place where we might see some of our own attachment to being so articulate so that the word can find its way in? As we approach the table tonight, we might ask, what are the words we do not yet have? What are the tyrannies we are swallowing day by day, attempting to make our own? Perhaps tonight as we gather, the disciples' heart is more to be silent and to listen. Perhaps there is a presence, a truth, a substance, a power, a home, an order, a safety. Speaking beyond our ability to voice it. I think we gather here around such a table, a story so entwined with our being, a practice that speaks so directly to the substance of who we are as people that need food, people that need drink, people that need a God who might meet us in the simplest and the profoundest of places. I think it's that sort of table that can hold these absences that we've been taking on, and even hold an absence of voice and speak powerfully to us tonight. So I invite you to come to that table. And I would say feel free to speak to each other. I think Monday, Thursday will be really deliberate about communing in silence, but tonight I won't put that upon you. But yeah, come in an absence of so much and in the presence of so much, and pour wine and juice for each other, break bread or cracker for each other, saying the body and blood, the light and love of Christ are here present in the midst of a great absence for all of us. Come to the table.
As I was started working on absence of voice and the text in Zechariah, it felt odd to have a traditional dialogue, really the voice of our gathering on a night when we were looking to the absence of voice and what that means, and perhaps what does it mean for silence to be a discipline rather than something that makes us uncomfortable? How might God speak? How might mystery enter into our lives in silence so then that we may have a more powerful word and a more honest word to proclaim? And so tonight, we're going to engage in two practices with the text. There will be talking at the end. There will be some voice, so I'm not making you be silent for 9 months like Zechariah, or even probably, you're gonna be silent for longer than 9 months, but not 9 months. So we're going to engage in a guided meditation of holy imagination, which is an Ignatian spiritual practice. Maybe some of you have done it in one form or another. There are different variations, but it will involve me leading us through some relaxation and meditation, and then we'll enter into the scene with Zechariah and the angel. And you will be in that scene for the reading of two times reading through the text. And there will be different prompts or things that I ask you to reflect on during that. And then after that, out of that silence and meditation, we are actually going to create our own erasure poems, like Rhody has been creating each week for us, and really practice and think about what does it mean to take away words, to take away some aspects of voice, to create something new, perhaps something more profound, subversive, or perhaps for you, something that feels true. Then we'll talk about it, because you can thank James that y'all are talking, because initially I didn't have any. So I would invite you all to just get in a comfortable position, whatever's comfortable for you. I'm not going to ask that you have to have 2 feet on the floor, because I don't find that comfortable myself. So whatever's comfortable for you, just find a comfortable seated position. And before we begin, it's important to remember a few things. Visualize the events as if you were making a movie. Pay attention to the details, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, and feelings. Lose yourself in the story. Don't worry about if it's right or wrong. Don't worry if your imagination you feel is running too wild or heretical or in a place that you weren't expecting. And it's important to remember that as we're contemplating this gospel scene, it's not merely remembering it or recounting it. But it's being open to what might happen. While you are in this text and in this scene, in a more silent, reflective way. So, now that everybody's in a comfortable position, I would invite you to close your eyes. If that doesn't feel safe or good, I just invite you to find a spot on the floor to gaze at. And breathe in, and breathe out. And breathe in, and breathe out. And breathe in, and breathe out. As you breathe in this next time, I want you to start imagining a warm ball of light is resting itself on your forehead. It's not harsh light. It's not too hot. It's just this nice, warm ball of light on your forehead that's slowly moving back and forth and back and forth. And as the tension that so many of us carry on our foreheads, as that tension starts to loosen, imagine that warm ball of light rolling to the top of your head. Back and forth, and back and forth. As the light touches your head, the tension begins to release, and you find yourself breathing in and breathing out a little more deeply. Once the top and back of your head have been released of tension, imagine that same ball of light rolling down your neck. And hitting the place where your shoulders and your neck come together. Moving back and forth, and back and forth. Slight releasing all tension and worry that you carry in those places. Slowly that ball rolls over to your right shoulder, moving back and forth. Then when you're ready, that ball moves down your right arm and back up. Now the ball rolls onto your hand, touching all of your fingers. Releasing any tension and stress. And when you're ready, that warm ball of light comes back up your right arm, releasing the last bit of tension, and slides over to your left shoulder. Going back and forth, back and forth. And then it rolls down your left arm, this warm ball of light. As as you breathe in, as you breathe out. Tension, anxiety, worry, even the noise of our joyful kids starts to dissipate. And that ball moves to your left hand, into your five fingers. As you breathe in and out. And when you're ready, that warm ball of light works its way up your left arm one more time and begins rolling down your spine. Vertebrae by vertebrae. With every breath in and with every breath out, it slowly moves down your back, relaxing you, reminding you that it is okay to be present in this space, and just focus on your breath, breathing in and breathing out. Way down your spine. It goes down your right leg, up and down, and up and down, relaxing every muscle and joint in your right leg, allowing you, as it touches your leg, to release any tension or worry that you carry here. Breathe in and breathe out. And then when you're ready, the warm ball of light touches your left leg and goes up and goes down, up and down. As you breathe in, breathe out. So slowly, that warm ball of light works its way from the bottom of your leg all the way up to where your eyes are. And as the ball of warm light first gets to where your gaze and your eyes are, it is dark. There's a dark screen in front of you. But as you breathe in and as you breathe out, the screen begins to fill with light. A warm, comforting light. And you begin to notice that it's not just light, but there is a scene in front of you. And with every breath in and with every breath out, that scene gets slightly more vivid, do you find yourself in a place you haven't been before? The hill country of Judea. During the rule of King Herod, Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife, Elizabeth, was a descendant of Aaron. They were both righteous before God, blameless in their observance of all the Lord's commandments and regulations. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to become pregnant, and they were very old. One day, Zechariah was serving as a priest before God. Because his priestly division was on duty, following the customs of priestly service, he was chosen to be lottery to go into the Lord's sanctuary and burn incense. All the people who gathered to worship were praying outside during this hour of incense offering. An angel from the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw the angel, he was startled and overcome with fear. The angel said, "Don't be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayers have been heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, will give birth to your son, and you must name him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many people will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the Lord's eyes. He must not drink wine and liquor. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth. He will bring many Israelites back to the Lord their God. He will go forth before the Lord, equipped with the spirit and power of Elijah. He will turn the hearts of fathers back to their children, and he will turn the disobedient to righteous patterns of thinking. He will make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah said to the angel, "How can I be sure of this? My wife and I are very old." The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand in God's presence. I was sent to speak to you and to bring this good news to you. Know this, what I have spoken will come true at the proper time. But because you didn't believe, you will remain silent, unable to speak until the day when these things happen. As you are in the hill country of Judea, what do you sense? What do you see? What do you touch, feel, and hear? What part of the story are you drawn to? Which character do you identify with? Elizabeth? Zechariah? Gabriel? The crowd? A bystander? Identify with you. Experience the story and the role of the character you are drawn to. As you hear the story and imagine the scene, what do you feel? How does this relate or not to something in your life today? The warm light opens up the scene. During the rule of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife, Elizabeth, was a descendant of Aaron. They were both righteous before God, blameless in their observance of all the Lord's commandments and regulations. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to become pregnant, and they were both very old. One day, Zechariah was serving as a priest before God because his priestly division was on duty. Following the customs of priestly service, he was chosen by lottery to go into the Lord's sanctuary and burn incense. All the people who gathered to worship were praying outside during this hour of incense offering. An angel from the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw the angel, he was startled and overcome with fear. The angel said, "Don't be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayers have been heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, will give birth to your son, and you must name him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many people will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the Lord's eyes. He must not drink wine and liquor. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth. He will bring many Israelites back to the Lord their God. He will go forth before the Lord, equipped with the spirit and power of Elijah. He will turn the hearts of fathers back to their children, and he will turn the disobedient to righteous patterns of thinking. He will make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah said, "How can I be sure of this? My wife and I are very old." The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand in God's presence. I was sent to speak to you and to bring this good news to you. Know this, what I have spoken will come true at the proper time. But because you didn't believe, you will remain silent, unable to speak, until the day when these things happen." As you breathe in and breathe out and find yourself on this hillside, what for you is resonating? Where are you feeling tension? Where is hope manifesting for you on this hillside? Or perhaps curiosity? Might an absence of voice not only mean for Zechariah here, but also for you? Still notice your surroundings in the hillside of Judea. What you see, what you feel, what you smell. But begin noticing your breath again in this space. Feel the floor beneath your feet. Feel the red chair on which you sit. Sense the people around you. Begin to hear their breath. Notice the light glimmering in as your eyes are closed. Still feel the warm ball of light upon your forehead. But slowly feel that ball of light melt away. And ever so slowly, open your eyes. As you start to come back to this space, we're going to spend some time in silence reflecting on this encounter in Judea through erasure poems. In the absence of voice, from some of these characters, in the absence of words, what might emerge? Erasure, in many ways, an erasure poetry is similar to the practice we engage in at Advent, De Turnima, taking one thing and turning it into something. Taking something, perhaps, that we wrestle with or are uncomfortable by, and flipping it on its head, subverting it, declaring something new and possible in its space. And how erasure poems normally work is that you are given a text, which we are going to pass around. So just take one and pass. And this is the entire text that we just did a meditation on. And then you get to take a Sharpie and mark out all the words that you don't want to be there. Some people choose to do erasure poems thematically. So perhaps the theme that emerged for you from the meditation is just something that's stirring in your life. And you can try to create an erasure poem around a theme. Perhaps you want to have a system to how you create the erasure and tell yourself, on even lines, I'm going to erase every word but the fifth and sixth word in that line. And on odd lines, I'm going to erase every word but the third and fourth. It's another way to do it. You could also just read the text, and as a word doesn't feel right, or you're just like, don't want that, just cross it out. It's up to you. I would encourage you, as you read this text and engage in this practice, to see perhaps what is resonating with that last question with you around absence of voice. What is it that you might be needing to learn or being prodded by the Spirit along? And thanks to the kids, we have books for you. So you can write it down. And you do not have to share these when you're done. But there will be a time for people to share. As you finish up, you're going to engage in voice and how voice fills this space in two steps. guided meditation out of the creation of your poem. In the absence of voice, what filled that space for you? In the presence of more silence, what was or is stirred up for you? Perhaps that means sharing your erasure poem, but you don't have to. Yeah, just share with somebody beside you or two or three people beside you what you're thinking, feeling, reflecting on in the absence of voice out of this meditation. And you can say like you need it. That's
during the meditation, I really got to thinking about Elizabeth and what that must have been like for her to have her husband come home and not be able to talk, but somehow convey to her, you're going to have a baby, and how that must have just been, I mean, I just can't even wrap my head around what that must have been like for her to, and not be able to
Do you think that Elizabeth could read, because he could write it to her if she could read, but if she can't read, that's hard.
Probably not.
I'm thinking pantomime.
Silence of just part of why I struggle with silence is it feels so isolating. It's like I want to make sure that people know that I'm here. So then for Zachariah to have had like just isolation on top of isolation. Others though, what's sticking out for you after this absence of voice dialogue? And just this notion of silence, well, the tension of silence and voice, redaction of words, the power of words.
Zachariah's been a priest his entire life, and there's just an implication here, a little bit, of the sense of custom and order and like all the sort of ritual that had gone into his life as a priest. And you know, he's going in to practice and all of a sudden the angel shows up. And I imagine that that's probably the first angel that Zachariah's seen, right? In his priestly family and caste, like how many stories have he seen about people that saw angels? And it happens, and he has this moment of disbelief, and then it's like, and now you can't talk about it. And that's probably the most dramatic thing that can happen, not just in his life, but maybe in the like generations of this family, like vocation of speaking about before God, and then he was supposed to be quiet. And so I wonder about that space between finally having something to say, and the angel saying, no, 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 just sit on it.
I think she wondered, too, right, like after this experience of seeing, like having Gabriel come, and then this forced, right, I mean, forced silence, if it caused Zachariah to be more open to how, right, the mystery and spirit of God was at work, because it's so, right, like cut through his day to day, that it ended up being more profound, right? But if the angel came and then everything like stayed the same, even with the baby, right, the unexpected child, but how maybe even Zachariah would have, I think that I probably would have tried to convince myself that that had not happened, right? That it was like used language to talk my way out of something. But instead, he's forced to like sit in it.
But there are instances where Jesus commanded people to be quiet. Right?
Yeah.
And it makes me think that maybe there are some things that God can't do unless we just shut up. We tend to think quite the opposite.
I think too, I've been thinking of not only we shutting up, but what does it mean to be silent so that others whose voices who have been speaking but haven't been heard, right? Like, there needs to be space created. Who's speaking that we can't hear because our voices seem to be more dominant and more important? Right? And like Zachariah, I think of the priest, like, held authority and, how might silence? I always am haunted by other words, that excerpt on voice and speaking, and just how God might be inviting us, some of us, all of us, to embrace more, be open more to an absence of voice, or at least a presence of silence, so that other voices that have been far too absent can be heard. Any last thoughts or feelings on this?
Well, I was going to say something totally different, but then I realized that, yeah. What I was going to say would be prone to be the dominant voice.
You can't
No.
You can't.
But
I didn't say that.
I was just thinking about this practice that I sometimes do when I teach called Save the Last Word for Me. And it's where students in groups of four, someone picks the text and then others are supposed to respond to it in a minute time frames, but they have to speak, either speak for that full minute or sit in silence. But there has to be a time frame that holds the minute for each. And then the person that picks it gets 2 minutes to talk about why they picked the passage. And every time I do that exercise and then I talk to students afterwards, they inevitably hate it. And because they find it awkward, they find it difficult, but they also hate it for different reasons, because those who like to talk a lot hate having to be constrained. And those who never have the opportunity or aren't listened to are like newly sort of forced to kind of speak into the silence. And then usually as you do it more often, then people, by the end, if you do it 2 or 3 times in a semester, they really like it by the end, because they appreciate that space that's been created for everyone to speak and everyone to intentionally. Save the last word for me, yeah.
Maybe we could do a dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks for engaging in some silence tonight in the absence of voice. I hope that all of these absences throughout Lent have made and continue to make us think and continue to be shaped by them, so that we might be able to pay more attention to God at work in unexpected, surprising ways in the absence, as the very presence of possibility in different ways. Elizabeth selected a really beautiful confession for us tonight, and is going to lead us in confession and a question of gratitude.
Here it is from Christian Martin to my brothers. St. Augustine's famous phrase at the end of his endless book on the Trinity. We have said this not in order to have said something, but in order not to have remained altogether silent. How many theologians have I heard quote this self-justifying sentence, as if the only alternative were between a kind of iron-willed industriousness and impotent silence. Augustine isn't to blame. Elsewhere he says, if you think you've understood God, it is not God. But contemporary interpretations of that one sentence should be balanced by another famous quotation, this one from Wittgenstein. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. The purpose of theology, the purpose of any speaking of God, is to make the silences clearer and starker to us, to make the unmeaning, by which I mean those aspects of the divine that will not be reduced to human meanings, more irreducible and more terrible, and thus, ultimately, more wonderful. This is why art is so often better at theology than theology is. And for our absolution, we have words from Zechariah after his months of silence. Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has looked favorably on his people and redeemed them. He has raised up a mighty Savior for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke through the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we would be saved from our enemies from the hand of all who hate us. Thus he has shown the mercy promised to our ancestors and has remembered his holy covenant, the the oath that he swore to our ancestor Abraham to grant us that we, being rescued from the hands of our enemies, might serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people by the forgiveness of their sins. By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace.
Now you all can talk. We're done. That was great. Thanks for coming and for doing something different with the dialogue tonight. As we're bread.